So of course, I know almost all of you guys, and you guys know me. So I've given talks here probably half a dozen times or so. So most of you have sat at one of my talks before. So it wouldn't be your first impression of me, hopefully. So that brings down the level of stress. And now this is going to be more of a dialogue, I hope, more than a seminar, because I think this is something I'm very excited about, and I'd like to know your opinion about it as my colleagues. And of course, don't hesitate to interrupt me at any time. So this was created last year. I guess those of you who came to my talk last year, that was before your time. There was the Perimeter Institute Observatory, and I guess the reason I came up with this was that I did my PhD at Princeton University Observatory, and I moved on to Harvard College Observatory. So naturally, I would come to Perimeter Institute Observatory, although it's really a fictitious institute, observatory. Well, not, the institute is fine, the observatory is fictitious. So. Yeah, this is my hour. Yeah. So this wasn't completely though a joke. So there is a bit more than this is a bit more than a joke. This symbol. I'm going to just explain why. Now, so I have a perception of physics, and I hope many of you share this. I know many of you share this with me that physics, a healthy physics program, it consists of really three steps. Called physics triangle or loop. This consists of coming up with theories that leads to consistent predictions that are tested against observations, which lead to theories and so on. And this loop may take longer depending on how hard the problem you're working on, but no matter what problem you're working on, and if you look at the history of the physics, all the successes, great successes that we hear about have gone through this loop at least once or several times. And that's something that we should always think about when we come up with new theoretical ideas, which puts this fictitious observatory in perspective, that if there's a theoretical physics institute, there must be an observatory that goes with it, although this may not be exactly the same building. So, and I guess I'm going to show you a number of examples of these loops that do happen in the program that I'm going to tell you about. But I think this is one of the important signatures of a healthy physics, that you can actually cycle through these loops. Compare observations can lead to theory, can lead to consistent predictions, and can be compared against observations. So with that in mind, this is the outline of my talk, and I'm in an awkward situation because this is the third talk in a series of three talks on the cosmological constant problem. So Andrew gave a talk a couple of days ago about his approach, the approach to the cosmological constant problem, and yesterday we had a colloquium on the cosmological constant problem, and so a lot of the introduction. Those of you who came to those talks would be familiar to you, but those who haven't might seem new. But then there are some differences of opinion that I have, especially with the colloquium that you heard yesterday. And in particular, things that were non-controversial, according to Raphael Bolso, I don't think it's can be very different, are controversial, and can have people can have very different perspectives about them. As you're going to see. So the outline is that I'm going to tell you about the history of cosmological constant problem. Probably most of you have heard this, but this may be a reminder. Then I'm going to tell you about the cosmic acceleration, the coincidence problem, and the ISW effect. And this is also part of the introduction, not the main part of the talk. And then I'm going to introduce you to a new way to solve a cosmological constant problem, through degravitating the quantum vacuum. Through a mechanism that I call gravitational ether. I'm going to tell you about verifiable tests of ether. And in particular, how in this scenario, formation of stellar black holes can lead to cosmic acceleration, which is basically one of the biggest puzzles that people have wondered about, why the universe starts accelerating now, or the coincidence problem. And then I'm going to end with conclusions and missing links and the future directions. So again, don't hesitate to interrupt me at any time. This is more of a dialogue than a seminar. And it's depending on how often you interrupt me, this may take a bit longer, but don't hesitate. Don't hesitate to do that. So this is a list of my collaborators. So Kazunori Kori at Lancaster. Gerald Grabers is a graduate student at Heidelberg, moving on to MPA. Tom Giblin is a postdoc here, actually. He's going to come here in a couple of weeks. Right now, though, he's at Bates College. Chanda Prescott-Weiss is a student who everybody knows here, I hope, is sitting there. And I'm supervising through this project, so we're working on this together. And very recently, actually, as of a couple of weeks ago, Michael Ballow, who I guess is not here, but this is the best picture I could find of him. So if if you see him, tell him to put a better picture online. If you say so, then okay, maybe I should have it harder. But this is so these are the people who have done a lot of calculations that I'm going to show you. So the history. So this is one page, one or two slide history of cosmological constant problem. In 1970, Einstein introduced a lambda term to his Einstein equations, to his equations of field equations for gravity, to make universe static. That was, of course, the state of the art observations at the time that universe was static. So this was a phenomenological requirement at that point. However, at the same time, even Pauli calculated the size of the Einstein universe, including a 0.1 quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field, the size of the Einstein universe, basically from this formula, including the energy of the vacuum, turned out to be 30 kilometers, and not enough even to fit the moon. So the problem was around, this interesting problem was around since that time, some 90 years ago. And at the same time, Hubble discovers that galaxies are actually at distances larger than 10 to the 16 kilometers. So there was already at that time some 15 orders of magnitude discrepancy, which was the cosmological constant problem. But then the other thing that Hubble discovered, that the universe isn't static, so there wasn't really any phenomenological need for lambda at that time, at least. So this is the history. Not that many people talk about the lambda problem for a long time after this. And of course, you have heard that Einstein have called this his biggest blunder, but I think that's a controversial issue. But there was no phenomenological need for lambda. But from the quantum field theory perspective, it has been a problem all along. In particular, for example, in 1989, Weinberg provides a no-go theorem in his review of the cosmological constant problem, that no local quantum field theory can actually give lambda equal to zero without fine-tuning. So there's no natural solution to this, at least in the context of local quantum field theories, which many people actually knew even back then. But this is a bit more formal way of putting forth a problem. Now, if there is no natural way of canceling lambda, the natural value that expect for lambda is something like 100 GeV to the fourth from the standard model of particle physics. And if you have other sectors, you would just add them to this. You could make it even bigger. Now, at the same time, in the 1990s, and in a completely different world, in the world of observations, cosmological observations, several of the independent probes, like microwave background, galaxy clusters, galaxy correlation functions, global cluster ages, and eventually supernovae within the 90s, provided independent evidence that there must be a lambda in the universe. There must be a constant energy density for vacuum, but at much smaller values, something like 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth. which led to two different problems. First, as was categorized by Weinberg, there are two problems. One is the old cosmological constant problem, why is it so small? And the second one is a new cosmological constant problem, otherwise known as a coincidence problem, but why does it become important now? So so there are these two sets of problems that any successful approach to solving cosmological constant problems should address. Now, just as an example for what happened in the 90s and later on in the observational world, I'm going to tell you about the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which is one of the ways that people can probe dark energy and prove that there must be dark energy or cosmological constants at late times. Now, the cosmological constant, as most of you know, leads to accelerated expansion of the universe, which results in decay of Newtonian potential. And this leads to the Stabler effect, that decaying Newtonian potential causes secondary anisotropy in the CMB temperature, which is proportional to the line of sight integral of phi dot. And this is also known as the Ricci-Yama effect, and this is basically how it happens. As the photon plunges into the potential, and the potential is changing, it gains energy, for example. And this is, say, potential for a structure. So this is Newtonian potential as a function of the space, and if there was no time dependence, then there wouldn't be an effect as you prime out of a potential. But since there is a time-dependent potential, there would be an integrated effect of this sort. And this only happens if there is accelerated expansion, if there is a Newtonian potential, evolving Newtonian potential, which requires either curvature or dark energy. Now, there are other reasons that why you think the universe doesn't have a spatial curvature. So if you detect this, that's the signature of dark energy. And actually, in the microwave background power spectrum, this is a very small effect at low Ls, at large angles, when the error is very large from cosmic variance. So you can't really detect this in the spectrum of cosmic microwave background itself. But one thing that our fearless director found out some 13 years ago was if you cross-correlate a cosmic microwave background with a galaxy survey, you can actually extract the ISW signal and basically out of the sea of primary anisotropies. And so this was an extraordinary claim at the time. Even lambda was controversial at that time. But this is something you would expect in a dark energy dominated universe. And this was measured later on in 2003 and 2004. This is one example that I was involved with through cross-correlation with two mass. At low Ls, you would see a positive cross-correlation. And high L, this is a different story. But low L, which is large angle, you expect a positive cross-correlation. This is a low signal to noise, but it's still a reasonable signal. And this can be done with different surveys. And I'm going to show you a summary of those. And this is basically independent evidence for the presence of dark energy. And this is not by far the most significant evidence, but certainly an independent one. Actually, in 2003, the consistency of different cosmological observations, including the ISW effect, Science Magazine considered it the breakthrough of the year. People may disagree on that, but this is something that was at that time, it was essentially established that every way that we look at the problem, there is an evidence for cosmic acceleration or dark energy. So it's actually there. Now, it turns out that this is not the best way to probe conventional dark energy properties like WW prom, et cetera, those of you who care about this. But it's a good probe of new physics close to the horizon scale. So this is a plot of the distribution of signal to noise for detection of ISW effect. It's a function of K, so the Fourier wave number. And it peaks around K of 0.01, which is, say, a scale of 300 megaparsec or so. And so galaxy surveys are sensitive to Ks larger than 0.01. So if there is new physics happening at very large scale, say, a scale of 1,000 megaparsec or so, the galaxy surveys wouldn't be sensitive to it, or maybe less sensitive to it. But then the ISW effect can actually pick it up somewhere. So you could have, at a few sigma, you're going to see differences in the ISW effect in cross-correlation. And the one thing that's a bit surprising is that if you actually look at the amplitude of ISW signal detections at different redshifts, all of them seem to be larger than what's predicted from the Lambda CDM model. So the two masses that I was involved with, STSS LRG, is another one. And there have been other groups that have done this at for surveys at different redshifts. All of them do have a detection, or well, some signal at a few sigma. If you combine everything, it's around 4 sigma detection. But all of them are larger, basically. On average, these are twice as big as what you expect from the theory. So could this be the first signs of IR modification of gravity? And this is something that Ghazal, Justin, and I have written on last year. There are actually other similar discrepancies that could be fit by a model that modifies in gravity in the IR. So this is a very promising, I believe, phenomenological avenue to the problem. But the biggest elephant in the room, though, still is the cosmological constant problem, even though these do give us some hints about what might be going on very large scales. We still have faced with this big problem, and until we can address this, there's a big issue. So this is another way of staying in the problem. If you believe in Einstein equations, and this is a semi-classical gravity, so we know that matter is quantized. Of course, quantum field theory is a very successful theory. But gravity, we haven't been successful in quantizing it. So the one way to combine these two is just take the semi-classical gravity where g mu nu is classical, and right-hand side, we have the expectation value of g mu nu. And of course, your state doesn't need to be vacuum. So you could do it with different states. But the thing is that there is a vacuum contribution to the right-hand side, which is about this 100 GeV to the fourth power. But left-hand side on the cosmological scale is 10 to the minus 3 electron to the fourth power. So there are some 60 orders of magnitude discrepancy. As you heard from the talk yesterday, the only known solution to this in the context of Einstein equation is what people call landscape. Maybe there are many different vacua at different vacuum densities. And with some anthropic reason, we cannot live anywhere else other than where this is much smaller than its natural value. Now, this is, many people take this very seriously. My problem and many other people's problem with this is that this is not the falsifiable, basically, theory. It relies on a whole structure outside the horizon, a whole landscape outside the horizon that we may never be able to see. So this is a solution. You can never rule it out. So it's always there. So if you cannot find a better solution, yeah, sorry. Yeah. This could be falsified. That's true. Yeah. I know your argument. So the question is zero a special point in the landscape or not? And so the current arguments all rely on assuming that zero is not a special point. But if for some reason quantum gravity or string theories tell me that zero cosmological constant is a special point in landscape, then it could be falsified. So that's true. So let me tell you my perspective on this. There is still the only prediction of this theory is that there is a lambda of some value. So the thing is that is there any other prediction or not? And that's really what I would hope for, because if you are inventing this whole landscape, this whole complicated structure to explain one single number, you can also just alternatively just start with a single number, which is a small. So I would prefer the one that just you have one single number and no landscape. to just introducing all this Liu structure to just explain that single number. But I would only like this if there are other predictions. And but that's the personal point of view. Others may disagree with me. And this is something that people can argue about for hours and days and years. I'm going to take an alternative point of view that if you don't like this, if you like this, you're fine. But if you don't like this, then you should modify this equation. And I think that's really the only way. You have to modify Einstein gravity. Of course, many people think this is a very hard thing to do. This has been tested very well, very thoroughly. But I think I'm going to argue that it's not, alternatives haven't been ruled out, and you can actually come up with alternatives that don't suffer from the same problem. Now, one thing that many people, especially people who work on a string theory of quantum gravity, wonder about is that could quantum gravity actually solve the cosmological constant problem? And I think the answer is no. And because quantum gravity models, at least the ones that are present right now, by construction, they reduce to GR plus effective field theory at low energies. So this is what you really have. At low energies, you have GR plus effective plus a standard model plus a lambda, which is of order E cut off to the fourth. And at very high energies, you have a string theory. But you have this very sensitive dependence on the cutoff energy. So if you cannot really match these two in a model independent way and keep lambda small. Now somebody may think that like supersymmetry would make this naturally small. I don't think even that's true, because you could have non-perturbative effects, for example, during electroweak phase transition. You could get contributions of disorder. And that's really the problem, that no matter what your quantum gravity theory is, as long as it reduces to GR plus a standard model, depending on exactly how you do the matching, there would be this huge contribution. And of course, I cannot make this very rigorous until I know what this theory is, but this is the general sense that this problem cannot be solved through understanding quantum gravity. Yes? So you're saying the vacuum energy should come out of the quantum gravity? Yeah, so the question is, why should it be so close to zero, basically? Because all the scales in this theory are Lupankian or at best larger than a few TeV. So, but then you're changing GR. But then GR vacuum energy does gravitate. Okay. So don't you agree that if this quantum gravity reduces to GR at low energies, then you have a problem?
I'm just saying that when you write this
time, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I know that some people. Now, I don't think that that's actually that can solve the problem, but the people who are more qualified should answer this. I don't think the normal ordering actually is a solution.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, okay, so. I guess so. This isn't a rigorous proof, so you might disagree with me. But I think a general sense, okay. So, but there could be Alejandro. Yeah. It could be. That's definitely true. The only question is why is it so small? That's the question. But sorry, Mark. Yeah, so that's true. I agree with that. But even if for some reason you think normal ordering kills the vacuum expectation, that only kills the perturbative contributions. But you could have non-perturbative effects like the electrophilic phase transition, and it's just a constant, like which is basically 200 GeV to the fourth. So the question is, do you make this zero or do you make this zero? And the thing is that which one of these would be the right thing too? Yeah, so this is certainly, I haven't seen a problem, but there's a general sense, at least it seems that this is quantizing general relativity is not the answer. I might be wrong on that. Well, it's me. The right way to do it is come up with a model that does it, and that model doesn't reduce to GR at low energy, at least the models that I know of. So I think the solution, at least our obvious one, is that to change the classical gravity, although there could be more clever ways that I haven't thought of. Now, it seems that parameter is a very fertile ground for coming up with solutions to the cosmological constant problems. All the ones that I know of that are not anthropic have come out of here. So there are two, what you've heard from Andrew about a couple of days ago. There's a supersymmetric large extra dimensions, which essentially you live in a co-dimension two brain, and there are two extra dimensions. And the idea is that lambda, a large cosmological constant, is a large tension on this brain, but it only carries the extra dimensions. And many people, but specifically Cliff Burgess, Claudia here in the audience, Andrew, and others have worked on this. So that's the possibility that lambda doesn't care about universe, but rather the extra dimensions. And this is, the size of this is 10 micron, and that actually can explain the size of the cosmological constant today as well. So that's a possibility. Another one that Justin Corey, Stefan Hoffman, Pia Duvalli, Andrew again, and Claudia, and others have worked on, is a so-called cascading gravity, where our universe is again a co-dimension two brain, but in an infinite six-dimensional bulk. But then our co-dimension two brain is actually embedded in a co-dimension one brain, which is, this is 5 plus 1 dimension, and the bulk is 6 dimension. And a six-dimensional bulk could be embedded in a 7-dimensional bulk, and so on. So this is a cascading gravity model, and in principle, similar thing that could happen, that the infinite extra dimensions can filter out long wavelength modes, including lambda. So there could be a big lambda where we live, but it doesn't gravitate because it's filtered out by the gravity in extra dimensions. So these are the two possible solutions, and the idea is basically to degravitate the quantum vacuum, or the vacuum, but then the implication is that you're really changing your theory of gravity. It's not general relativity anymore. You're adding these extra dimensions. You don't have 4 dimensions general relativity, at least. Now, I've worked on these as well, and I have my own perspective. Now, they suppressed observed lambda in a technically natural way. So it's the value of lambda that you get at late times, it's independent of the UV physics or quantum gravity. So it's good. And are also very testable if you actually can solve the full theory. So, but they are actually very hard theories. That's why it's going to take a while for us to come up with the predictions. But when they are developed, they are very testable. However, they don't solve the coincidence problem. The scale at which the universe started accelerating should be put in by hand. And one way, and it's probably a bit playing devil's advocate here, but it's a bit pessimistic about thinking about it, is that you're replacing one anomalously small number or parameter with infinite number of dynamical variables that are two extra dimensions.
You might tune some numbers with a then stable against the corrections.
Yeah. So you might tune some numbers.
There is some tuning, but then it's stable against quantum
corrections. That's true, exactly. So it is a stable against quantum correction, but then there could be classical corrections, basically. So if you're adding all these new dynamical variables, then you have to, for example, worry about the initial conditions and how things. So that may be a concern, may not be a concern, depending on how you initiate the problem. I think generally, at least for the models that I've worked on, it seems that there is always a memory effect, or initial conditions are a bit something to worry about. But since we haven't been able to completely solve this, we don't know how big a worry this is. But basically, the problem is that you have all these new dynamical variables, and you have to initiate them. Do you agree with that? Yeah.
I'm not sure.
So you have to set the initial conditions in some way to make them work. So far, yes. Maybe there is a way out of this. Now, so what I'm going to tell you next, and this is the part that I'm going to want you all to hear to very critically. I'm going to introduce a degravitation model, so basically a model to decouple gravity from the vacuum with no extra free parameters, as opposed to the one single parameter that you had, so that was small lambda. There is no extra free parameters and no new dynamical degree of freedom. So it's very ambitious, and there's a good chance that it's wrong, but either you're going to tell me why it's wrong in the next 20 minutes or so, or the experiments in the next 10 years will be able to rule it out, or hopefully none of the above. So this is the alternative, which is what I call gravitational ether, and you're going to find out why. So imagine the simplest thing. So your Einstein equation was g mu nu, equals t mu nu, and this is that there are expectation values here, which I stopped writing them. What if we just subtract the vacuum, which is basically the part of the t mu nu that's proportional to metric on the right-hand side? So now, your t mu nu, which is the vacuum contributions proportional to g mu nu plus excitations, the vacuum part is now subtracted on the right-hand side. So this doesn't gravitate anymore, because the excitations can still do something, because these two terms wouldn't exactly cancel. But as a part that's proportional to the g mu nu, the trace is canceled by construction. So here is a very explicit way to degravitate the vacuum. Now, there is a problem with this, and that's why I had three dots here. You have to satisfy Bianchi identity. We know just from mathematics that g mu nu, the Einstein tensor, has zero divergence. And from energy momentum conservation in any metric theory, and equivalence principle tells us that the gravity must be a metric theory, and that has been verified to very good accuracy. We know that t mu nu should have zero divergence. But then this guy, he doesn't have zero divergence in general. So this t is the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So in order to make it a consistent theory, you have to add a term to cancel the divergence of this term against something else. And I call this T prime, and the Bianchi identity tells you that the divergence of this should cancel the divergence of the gradient of, should be equal to 1/4 of gradient of T. And T is, again, the trace of the energy momentum tensor. T prime is a new component. Now, further, I'm going to assume that, so I'm a cosmologist, I'm going to assume that this is a perfect fluid, this T prime, and this is what I call ether. So U mu is something like a velocity of ether, pre prime is something like the pressure of ether, and omega is something like a equation of the state of ether, so the ratio of pressure to density of ether. Now, so this is a theory on its own. It actually has no new degrees of freedom. Well, it has one new fluid in it. There is no new parameters, actually, except for omega. So I have introduced a new fluid with a new parameter omega. But actually, I'm going to show you that omega, I'm going to let omega go to infinity eventually. So there is no new parameter in this theory. This is, has the same number of parameters as GR. And actually, I'm going to argue next that in that limit, there is no new dynamical degree of freedom either in the theory. So as I promised, there won't be any new parameter or any new degree of freedom in the theory. No. And that's what I'm going to come. And I think that's not necessarily a problem. But that's one thing. That's why nobody has really come up with this before. But I can argue that it's okay. So you can start to do cosmology with this theory. And you don't have to go through all these equations. I have a couple of pages of this. But some important features are going to emerge that you probably want to remember for the rest of the talk. You can come up with something like an effective Friedman equation. But instead of rho on the right-hand side, you have a rho effective, which is a combination of the first term that you had from ordinary gravity, the second term, which subtracted a trace, and the third term that's due to ether. And if you have a constant P over rho equation of a state for the matter in the universe and a constant omega for ether, then there is actually an inhomogeneous solution to this equation that ether basically exactly follows the evolution of matter. There is an attractor solution, let's say, that ether follows matter. So the density of ether follows the density of matter. And eventually, you can write P prime in terms of rho, and T is, of course, a function of rho and rho as well for a given W. So this is what you find, though, that there is rho effective, which is proportional to density of matter, with these prefactors that now depend on the equation of a state of matter. So there is an effective G now that depends, that appears on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, or Friedman equation, that depends on the equation of the state of matter. So different types of matter source gravity differently. If omega and W are the same, yes, that's true. So what I'm going to, of course, omega is a free parameter. You say why that's the case? Yeah, so then in that case, there is no attractor. So I'm assuming that the ether gets to an attractor. But if omega is actually less than W, there is no attractor. So that solution is ill-defined, essentially. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to let omega go to infinity. So this is not going to be a concern. And actually, when omega goes to infinity, this becomes just 3/4 of 1 plus W. Now, but even if I don't let omega go to infinity, there is a striking thing that there is a G that depends on W now, on the equation of a state. For example, if you compare radiation to matter, the ratio of G for non-relativistic matter to G for radiation, so that's, I set that W equal to 0, and then W equal to 1/3 for radiation, this is going to be 3/4 minus 1 over 4 omega. That for any positive omega, which if you require for a stable fluid, this is going to be less than 3/4. So in this model, radiation and matter gravitate differently. And that's a prediction of this model, a firm prediction of this model that can be tested and has been, actually. So you can use Big Bang nuclear synthesis to compare G during radiation era to G during matter era. And this is around 1, so this is consistent with GR. So this is inconsistent with this at around 2 sigma, 2.5 sigma level. Now, surprisingly, though, and for those of you who haven't heard about Big Bang nuclear synthesis, basically you can calculate how many nuclei of different kinds are produced in the early universe in the radiation era. And since the universe is dominated by radiation at that time, you can put the constraints on the G at that time. If you compare your result with observations of helium and deuterium and lithium and other things in the universe. This particular constraint comes mainly from helium for observations. Now, interestingly, there are other cosmological constraints from larger scale structure, particularly combining WMAP3 and Lyman alpha, which gives you exactly what you predict here. So G Newton divided by G during radiation era is 0.73 plus or minus 0.04 from this paper by Selzacher, Stosar, and Pat McDonald, who was here about a month ago. So there is some discrepancy between these two numbers, but it's also interesting that this one seems to prefer GR, but this one seems to prefer our theory here, this for omega, for large enough for omega. And this, of course, will be tested very well in the future. And I'm gonna try to convince you that actually data prefers this rather than this. So one thing is that if you want to take any of these values, omega cannot be too small, because then this discrepancy would be too big. So omega should be larger than 5, just from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And you may wonder that you have supernominal propagation, if, because the speed of sound is the square root of p divided by rho, which is larger than 1. So that's required by data. But then I argue that this doesn't violate causality, and other people have said this, like Mukhanov and others, and Steinhardt and others. In KSS models, this generically happens. So in order to violate causality, you need to propagate information on closed loops. And this is a required condition for that to happen. But this doesn't necessarily lead to closed loop propagation information or violation of causality. Another model that we've worked on with Ghazal and Daniel Chang is the a specific case where a speed up sound or omega goes to infinity, in which what actually happens is that information does not propagate. So you cannot violate causality because there is no information to be propagated. And this is a very special case that we call Pascuton. Now, what happens is that field or fluid equation in this case become constrained equations. That's why you don't have propagation information. That's why you don't violate causality. And we're gonna for this particular because these are interesting features, I'm gonna stick to this case where speed of sound and omega go to infinity. So essentially, since omega is pressure of ether divided by density of ether, says that ether has zero density. So that's just a construction of model. I fixed the only parameter in the model. And what happens is that this looks like now like an incompressible fluid, because that's what an incompressible fluid does. It has infinite speed of sound. But then another thing that we know about incompressible fluids is that it has no dynamical degree of freedom. That is, it doesn't have any propagating dynamical degree of freedom. So now the ether theory that I presented to you has no free parameters and no new dynamical degree of freedom other than what you already had in general relativity. Of course, gravitons and things like that are still there, but ether doesn't introduce anything new, any new parameters. So ether equation is just a constraint equation there. Now, this is a bit complicated, and I'm going to probably go through it a bit quickly, but this is the real BBN constraints, and I'm going to argue that it's not conclusive that ether value is ruled out. So general relativity says that G Newton divided by G Newton at radiation error is 1. Ether, in the limit that omega goes to infinity, has this at 3/4, 0.75. Now, this is from CMB, which allows both of these if you just have CMB. This YP, these red areas, is 2 sigma and 3 sigma constraints from helium-4 abundances, if you compare the BBN predictions. And that rules out ether at around 2 sigma, between 2 and 3 sigma. But then if you look at lithium abundances, actually, BBN has a problem with GR. And the gravitational ether, it just happens to be on the corner of the 2 sigma region from lithium. So, and deuterium is more or less consistent with both of them. So it actually turns out that lithium-7 is at a few sigma, 2 or 3 sigma, inconsistent with general relativity, what prefers the ether. But helium-4 prefers GR to ether. So this is not conclusive.
I'm not going to answer that.
On the other hand, if you look at the structure formation at microwave background constraints, as I said, CMB alone doesn't distinguish between the two. So this is this green region is basically this is 1 sigma or 68% 95% region from WMAP5 alone. But if you include lamina alpha forests from a Sloan Digital Sky Survey, it actually prefers, and as I, so we did the reanalysis of the data, but this is the same thing that SLOSAR, McDonald, and CELDAC did before, essentially, that it prefers something something down here. It prefers ether to general relativity at around 2 sigma level. So these are the best fit value that is actually right on. The best fit value is right on the prediction of ether, which is 0.75. And it's, GR is at more than 2 sigma away from the best fit constraints. So this data actually prefers ether to general relativity.
In another parameter?
But it's a number of neutrinos. So because what you really see in cosmology is total amount of radiation times G at the radiation era. And one kind of radiation that doesn't interact with anything else are neutrinos. So if you have extra neutrino species, that's going to increase G times rho. So you could either say that G is larger, or you could say there are more neutrinos. So the way it's usually interpreted in data, like in a SLOSAR FL paper, instead of the SLOSAR and McDonald, was 5 neutrinos instead of 3 neutrinos. Mm-hmm. But you could also interpret it as energy that's different.
It's basically shifting matter radiation equality.
Exactly. So that's good. But then GR is a very well-tested theory. Can we satisfy everything else that we know? There are all these solar system constraints, everything else. And that's something that we have to make sure of. And so I'm going to tell you a mechanism that is supposed to do it. I'm going to tell you about a mechanism that's supposed to do it. I'm not 100% sure that it works in all situations. So that's something that needs to be worked out. And there are many experiments, or many tests of gravity that one has to go through. But the idea is that as I told you, ether follows, at least in the cosmological situation, ether follows matter. And in the limit that the speed of sound goes to infinity or omega goes to infinity, this happens all the time. Basically, this happens infinitely fast. The pressure of ether is minus 1/4 of the trace of energy momentum density, plus corrections at the small pressures, the small temperatures, for example, for non-relativistic matter, plus corrections that go as US squared or phi, and this for non-relativistic matter, these are small corrections, plus a constant. So if you just solve the equation of continuity equation for ether, this is what you find for non-relativistic situations. What you find further is that if you just you look at matter, go out and sit in the rest frame of matter, and look at the perturbation equation for ether, you come up with something that looks like this. And of course, omega is going to go to infinity. What you find in that limit is that the longitudinal modes of ether propagate superluminally and are very fast, essentially, and they disperse. So the compressional modes of ether are going to disperse in the rest frame of matter, which I interpret as that ether follows matter. Because this is basically you velocity of ether in the rest frame of matter, and that disperses with speed of basically infinite speed. So when you let omega go to infinity, basically it tells you that there is no divergence mode. There could still be rotational modes. So that's something to worry about, that ether and matter, ether has its own rotation, and that could be detected in principle. But as long as you don't see the rotation, or you don't care about rotation, or if for some reason your flow is irrotational, the compressional mode just follows that of matter. So basically, ether is dragged by matter, and its density, its pressure is also follows pressure of matter. The density of matter. And basically, this is my argument that in this limit, as long as ether follows non-relativistic matter, and if pressures are non-relativistic, then all you get is that G effective is 1 plus W times G. As long as W is close to zero, then you essentially don't see anything. Now, there is some small effect to, there could be a small sensitivity to pressure. So basically, wherever you had density in Einstein equation, now you have density plus pressure. If pressure is small, it doesn't matter. And it turns out this is the only parameterized post-Newtonian parameter in GR that is not constrained from experiments. So nobody has really tested whether G effective, this, the way you source gravity depends on pressure or not. So that's, and I should here emphasize that you're not breaking the equivalence principle. You are still, this is still a metric theory. It's just that the way you source gravity is different from it is in GR. So, and this is how you're going to be able to test this. As long as ether exactly tracks matter and internal pressure is negligible, basically this model is indistinguishable from GR. You do renormalize Newton's constant by constant factor, but you'll never be able to tell unless you go to relativistic pressures. So the only way to actually distinguish ether is either through rotation, and that's something that, for example, gravity probe B is supposed to do. That it's supposed to see the effect of rotation of Earth, and I'm not sure if it's going to be able to do it eventually. But that's something that has never been tested actually. It's called the gravitomagnetic effect, and also an internal structure of self-gravitating objects with relativistic pressure, like neutron stars or like supernovae. That's going to be sensitive to this, because as soon as your pressure becomes relativistic, then this effect is going to kick in, and you're going to, similar to the matter radiation transition, you're going to have non-trivial effects. So I think at least there is a procedure, or there is a mechanism by which this theory could be indistinguishable from GR, at least at non-relativistic pressures. But it one has to go through the details. Lee.
For the gravitomagnetic effect, is the same as GR or is it different from GR?
It's different because if matter does rotate, but ether doesn't rotate. So
it is different. So I don't have a reference for this, but I've been told that the lunar ranging measurements do test the gravitomagnetic.
So that's a good point. Actually, I talked to Chris Stopsalas, who's basically a PI on this experiment. And what is actually tested is not the rotation, but rather motion of sun, basically, relative to the Earth-Moon system. So it's some sort of rotation, but it's global rotation, but not local rotation. And I think there's a difference between the two. All I'm saying here is that ether is a rotation, so locally it does not rotate, but it can track.
So you're saying that the ether theory would give a different prediction for gravity probe B testing the gravitomagnetic effect than for lunar ranging?
Yes.
So you see through. That's right.
So what I'm yes, that's right. So I'm saying if you have something that's moving, then ether follows this, and if you have something that ether is basically at rest here. And when this planet comes through, it drags ether with it. And the same is true here for this other planet. So as long as these are exactly dragged, then there is no distinguished difference with GR. And ether could be completely rotational, and this could happen. But then as soon as you start rotating this internally, if there is actually internal rotation, ether cannot rotate, but the planet can rotate. And that's where you're going to see that.
I don't understand how you can be dragging in different directions and not have a rotation somewhere.
You do have, so there would be some difference. The question is, but here in the vacuum, there is no ether, basically. Well, the density of ether is zero. So that's, I think that's my answer. Yes, there could be a rotation here, but here there is basically the density of, or the pressure of ether is zero, so you don't really see anything.
Can you continuously go from one limit to the other? Because, I mean, I could imagine one planet being as
a... Yeah. Can you continuously go from... that's something that needs to be worked on. So that's something I'm not sure about. But so there is a difference here that if you have something, as long as this is much smaller than the distance between these two, then you can just imagine that this moving and there is no rotation. But if they get close, then there would be the rotation that you cannot regulate. So that's the mechanism. I cannot posit that this works exactly in all situations. But at least that's the idea that in through which this can work.
So what about binary first source, for instance?
It's the same thing.
They
are not this close, no. Actually, the reason you can do binary pulsars as a test of vacuum gravity is that they are far enough that you're not sensitive to the internal structure of binary pulsars. Because, but if you are, the thing is, if you are sensitive to the internal structure, then there is a whole list of things that you don't know about.
The internal structure, but the rotation of in between space,
but there is nothing in between.
Well, you need to.
No, so ether follows matter. So if the density of matter vanishes, then the density of ether. So that's the equation, essentially. If you ignore this constant, if P vanishes, then P prime vanishes. And the velocity is not well defined with the answer. But of course, there would be some density which is very small. So there could be something untrivial happening in between, but as long as the density is small, then it shouldn't affect gravity.
I mean, you're always going to run into examples like an accretion disk.
Yeah.
Just privately rotating.
So if you can actually test the gravity of accretion disk, then you can be able, you should be able to do it. And that's one of the examples I was telling you about the structure, self-gravitating structures with relativistic pressure. That could be one place you can test. Definitely.
Sorry, but it's, I don't understand why you need to. I mean, I don't understand why you need to look at the pressure or the gravitation of the accretion disk itself rather than the black hole, which has a frame dragging effect.
Well, black hole...
And I thought that had been seen, actually, the frame dragging around the black hole.
Around the black hole.
Yeah.
In what way?
In some, you know, anomalous redshift of the accretion disk.
I don't think that's true. But let me tell you.
It's consumed, but not necessarily frame dragging. And even that's controversial, so I think that's not true.
So there is a frame dragging.
It's another experiment.
But you see, the vacuum in this theory is the same, almost the same as GR. So all the Kerr solutions are still the same. It's just that if you put matter in there, then it's going to look different. And that's the thing. Most of the tests of gravity actually test the gravity in vacuum. Varies is equivalent, and it's just a coupling to matter, or the very source gravity that's different. Yeah, that's how you can think of it. Now, I know this is gonna take a while, but it's, as I told you, if you're gonna ask questions, it's gonna take a while, and I encourage you again to ask questions. So this is the way I hope I can get away. Maybe eventually you prove.
Yes. On the last one. I mean, qualitatively, can you tell me if I'm thinking about something like the Chandrasekhar bound, am I getting more pressure or less? And so am I pushing the bound up or
down? I don't know, but I think that would be exactly where you would be able to test this. It's something that Chandrasekhar, not for white dwarfs, but for neutron stars.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. And that's the thing that's not.
But
the
qualitatively,
thing,
do you know which?
I don't know, actually. No, I don't know. I think that would be one thing that needs to be calculated.
What would affect radius, the neutron star radius? Is that the...
Yes. The thing about... The reason...
More pressure is more like radiation than is more gravity.
That's true, yeah. I think that's what it's basically up to me. So you probably decrease the Chandrasekhar mass. At least naively, that's what I think. Because the same amount of mass gravitates more. So then you should probably decrease it. But then the Chandrasekhar mass is a tricky thing that you expect an instability at some point. Yes, and that naive expectation may not be the correct. But that's exactly what Mark said, that the same, because the equation of state becomes closer to radiation, you gravitate more. And the thing about the neutron star is that you also don't understand the equation of state of nuclear matter very well. So there's uncertainty tied into that when you want to. So we don't really know the Chandrasekhar mass for neutron stars very well. Lee?
Yeah, but there is a calculation of an upper limit just coming from causality and energy conditions. So would you say that would be pushed down?
Well, there are different definitions of causality, and I don't. So there's superluminality and causality, and this doesn't satisfy. the superluminality or the subluminality condition. So this ether has infinite speed of sound. So
yeah,
then,
but I think he was talking about the equation of state of the matter in the neutrons.
But that's, so that's what I'm saying. So that now you have two components of matter.
Yeah.
There's the ether and this other guy. And this the ether doesn't have subliminal properties, speed of sound. It has infinite speed of sound. So that's why I think that upper limit might change. That's my answer.
Okay, something to look
at. Yeah, it's definitely something to look at. Now there are two questions, and I'm sorry it's taking so long. So there are two questions. I don't have an action. You should leave.
So, but that's fine.
Okay.
Keep going.
Okay.
Somebody else can share. No, can you take over? Thank you.
So now physical theories should have an action. That's not necessarily true, and we have examples of that. Any coarse grain theory have information loss, so it's not unitary, so it doesn't need to have an action anymore. Well, it doesn't actually have an action anymore. And examples of that are like fluid mechanics doesn't have an action, like any of these processes, viscosity, turbulence, and diffusion, where you have microscopic information turning into microscopic information, that's information loss. None of them can be described by an action. Gravity action is, of course, is necessary to quantize gravity. That's the way we do quantum gravity. But what I described to you is a theory of classical gravity, or the quantum field theory in a classical curved space-time. And you only need an action for matter here, not for gravity.
So is it fair to call it a different theory of gravity, or is this a theory of matter?
I think it's a different theory of gravity. The coupling to a metric is the same as the Norton. It's still a metric theory, and you're not changing anything in the matter sector. It's just the way you're sourcing gravity.
Okay.
Physical theories should be local, and that's something that is my difference with the colloquium you heard yesterday again, and actually the other approaches also break locality to some extent. For example, if you take QED effective action for electrons, that is, if you integrate out photons, then you end up with a non-local action. You have action at a distance, like for example. Same is for gravity. If you have planets and you don't have gravitons, then you have action at a distance. So even though your fundamental theory might be local, your effective theory, in terms of the observable degrees of freedom, doesn't need to be local. So that's not really a requirement. This, in my opinion, perfect theory. The other example is extra dimensions in Brennwald model. That you might have things that look non-local to you in a four-dimensional setup, but it's just because you have communications through the extra dimensions that cannot be described in a local setting. And this is basically the point, that even if your fundamental degrees of freedom are local, your effective theory does not need to be local. So. That's my way to justify the infinite speed of sound, which is, at least naively, looks like an non-local action at a distance. So, anyway, so these are some theoretical concerns. I don't think these are big issues, but I think this is the reason that it took people 90 years to come up with a solution, because these two are really no-goes for solving the cosmological constant problem. And I think what I've shown through this example is that this is actually breaking these two conditions, requiring an action, and locality is exactly what you need to solve a cosmological constant, at least at the effective level. Now, you can actually go farther. You can explain the coincidence problem. You can so what we did, and this is what Chandra and I have done, was to solve the sulfur Schwarzschild metric, but in the presence of ether, and I assume a static configuration. And you come up basically with something that looks very similar to the Schwarzschild metric, but with this correction, and P naught is an integration constant, P is the pressure of ether, there is no matter in this setup. If P naught was zero, then this is exactly Schwarzschild metric. But if P naught is not zero, then you have this radius-dependent correction, that actually diverges at very large distances and very small distances. So no matter how small this peanut is, these corrections due to ether blow up at very far away from the black hole and very close to the black hole. So this very close to the horizon, it causes 1 over square root of r minus 2m, very far away, it causes r squared. So the same integration constant describes solution close to and far from the black hole horizon. So you have UVIR coupling in this theory. And so this is where magic happens. So it's within the next couple of lines. You can actually show that at the horizon, there's a maximum redshift. The redshift doesn't go to infinity. At r equal to 2m, redshift actually goes to this value, something that goes as, which is finite. If peanut was 0, it would be infinite, but it's actually a finite value. And if in some transpankian description of gravity, you assume that the maximum redshift should be Planck energy divided by the Hawking temperature, and this is something you might expect from some quantum theory of gravity. So this is what people think of as transplanckian corrections to gravity near black hole horizon. Then you set these two equal to each other, and you get P naught is something is minus 1 over 256 pi squared m cubed, which happens to be equal to minus observed dark energy density for mass of 73 solar mass.
Because you modified the right-hand side in that set of equations. But for a black hole departure solution, right-hand side.
That's one solution, yes. But you could also have solutions that are, that's it. So if P naught is 0, then they have Schwarzschild solutions. But if P naught is not 0, then that you can have a different solution. So that there is an integration constant.
So in spite of the fact I have no conventional matter, I have no source,
yeah,
still have the ether in that region.
That's true. You could have. You don't have to, but you could have. Now, I require in this boundary condition, if you do require this boundary condition, then that tells you that there must be some ether there. At a very negligible level, but still. And it happens to give the right scale of dark energy. So formation of a stellar black hole is triggered later on acceleration. That's the conclusion here. It doesn't sound very intuitive, but actually, if you just compare the De Sitter metric with the ether metric that I just derived, the last slide, in distances that are much larger than the horizon of a black hole, but much smaller than Hubble, you look at these two metrics, and the G0-0 component actually looks very much the same. And it turns out that non-relativistic particles, or slowly moving particles, only care about the G0-0, that's a Newtonian potential. And these two look very much the same. So basically, around every black hole, you could have acceleration away from the center. So as this happens around every black hole, the Coarse-Grained universe should look like, basically, lambda plus matter, with rho lambda being minus P naught. So I expand this at very small distances, about r as being a small. So these prefactors are the same. There's a difference in sign. So these, for non-relativistic particles, these two are essentially the same if rho lambda is minus. So that's, yes.
Ether in vacuum now, do you have some kind of preferred frame?
Yes.
Do you have some?
And this frame is essentially dragged by the black holes in this center. Because.
Then that's different than the test you were saying before.
Yeah, well, I wasn't talking about black holes here. Yeah. So the actual pressure here is a order of the pressure of the P naught that you get is the pressure of the cosmological constant. So for any test of gravity on a small scale, it's negligible. But yes, so there would be a preferred frame, which is only relevant cosmologically. So, now I know you're tired. This has been a long, in my defense, I actually started a bit late. and of course, you took your time to ask questions. That's fine. That's fair. That's what I ask. Now, this is the end of it. This is the last real start. Now, the question is, what happens if you have multiple black holes and we have some arguments that don't? The thing that matters is average mass weighted average of log m. So there's an m star, that's like the effective mass for a series coming if you have many black holes. And rho dark energy would go as 1 over m star cubed. So as supermassive black holes grow in the universe, you start with stellar black holes, but there are supermassive black holes at the center of the galaxy that grow. Basically, the prediction of a model of the dark rho dark energy should decrease. And this is actually the calculation Michael has done recently for me, that rho dark energy is a function of redshift within a model for formation of the stars and supermassive black holes would have time dependence that looks like this. So at late time, there isn't basically much AGN activity, much formation of the stars or black holes. So this remains constant. But at early times where there is a lot of activity, this M star is increasing, the mean density of the mass of black holes is increasing. That means rho dark energy or effective dark energy is increasing. This is now, all of these are consistent. So these are different models. These are all consistent with current data, but can be tested very well with future data. And you see, this is a difference of a factor of a trio. So it's a big difference. But since that happens at high redshift, it hasn't been tested. So that's it, basically. So I told you a way, without any new parameters or dynamical degrees of freedom, to decouple gravity from vacuum by introducing this ether component. The firm prediction of the model is that G for matter, for sourcing gravity by matter, is different from sourcing gravity by radiation by this factor of 3/4. And it's actually preferred by cosmological observations, or the Big Bang into the center is inconclusive. Most interestingly, it ties horizon physics of a stellar black holes to cosmology. That could explain the coincidence in late time acceleration in the universe. And essentially, this is all you need to solve the cosmological constant problem. So that's my claim. And to satisfy all the tests of GR, ether needs to follow non-relativistic matter. And this is the way I think it can satisfy tests of general relativity, but this needs to be carried out more thoroughly. So this might be the way to rule out this scenario. But it's already very, very, very encouraging, very suggestive that you can actually solve all these problems and make all these predictions with this simple model. So there are future CMB large scale structure surveys will be able to rule this out. Measure this with 10 times accuracy. So in 10 years, you're going to either rule it out or confirm the scenario. Rotation, gravity probe B, gravity Magnetic effect would be one way to test this. What I showed you is the black hole vacuum space time. But in fact, you have matter in the universe and you have multiple black holes. How to patch these up to make an average accelerating of RW, that's needs to be done. There are correlations, there could be correlation between the star formation or AGN activity and cosmic acceleration that can be tested with joint dark energy emission or Euclid, the European version. So these are all very testable predictions that can be, I've already told you what the predictions are, or some of them need to be worked out, but they cannot be done easily. And they will be all tested in the next 10 years. Now, this theory is different from GR. So if you want to quantize it, you'll be quantizing a different theory. So that could shed some light on this program to come up with a fundamental theory of gravity and how to quantize it. And the ether is related to the directions that people are pursuing in the quantum gravity community known as emergent gravity or quantum gravity, that Lorentz invariance is not fundamental, but rather something, an emergent symmetry. And you have actually some sort of a crystal or lattice at very high energies, which breaks Lorentz invariance. And that could be something very much like ether. And so maybe we should revisit. So these are the questions I'm going to leave you with. Maybe we should revisit our assumptions for constructing effective theories, for example, locality or an action. Or maybe we should reevaluate our dark energy program. This is the theoretical lesson, and this is the observational lesson. And I guess finally, I'm going to just advertise that we're going to have a workshop here. Claudia, Hazal, and I, with Yadaval, we are going to basically look at all the possible solutions, look at marginal transitive problem, maybe it's the end. So, thank you.
So you might have said it, but what's the gravitational exchange in between?
It's not a well-defined question in this because.
No, but you can cheat the thing. I mean, you can the nearest gravity. You have your actual.
Yeah.
So.
But it's going to depend on the equation of the state of. So, if, for example, if you talk about photons, then there is no. No difference between GR. So that's the thing. So
that's because the trace kinetic.
That's
kinetic.
Right.
So is it going to be Tmu minus a half Tmu and then something else? What will be the something else?
Well, I think it's minus, well, depends on what Peter does. So that's really the thing.
Because I'm just asking that because usually when you want to depart from that means that there's some extra degrees of freedom in the graviton itself.
Yes.
So,
I don't know. I feel that this is not a well-defined question because ether, so this is going to depend on the properties of, so you're asking if these are like perturbations. These aren't real particles, or?
Well, I would like to have a real thing, but you can do it as a.
By the way, I'm saying it depends on the equation and the state of the particle. It might be different if these are neutrino stars or if these are non-relativistic particles.
If I have a stressing GTV, and it can be some radiation, it can be a planet.
Yeah.
How will they couple through the exchange of one graviton?
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is not a very fun question. But the reason is that, ether is not a perturbative degree of freedom, so it has. But to be frank, I haven't calculated it.
Mike. So are you saying that? I'm not sure I understood the last part. If you have a black hole that has this repulsive effect at large distances, which looks like a cosmological constant, would it? One, let's say it's a one solar mass black hole.
Yeah.
The same one solar mass that's not a black hole still have the same effect?
No.
So where does it come from?
So it comes from this boundary condition that they've imposed.
I mean, what physically happens if the thing collapses to a black hole and then all of a sudden it starts repulsing?
Yeah.
Across the universe?
And what distance does that become important?
Seems weird.
Well, that's the horizon scale. Because P0 has a scale of the cosmological constant. But the thing is that if I don't have a horizon, then this I don't have a condition, basically. So I would say that this happens when your redshift actually, your maximum redshift increases this limit. But then this relies on some quantum gravity effect that fixes the maximum redshift. If your maximum redshift in the star, for example, doesn't exceed this, then you can use just classical, hydrostatic equilibrium within the star or whatever the equation is.
I understand mathematically. What's the physical explanation? If I've got a particle over here and I have a one solar mass star and nothing happens, and then this thing suddenly collapses to a black hole, and all of a sudden this guy over here starts feeling repulsion, it seems.
So you're saying it happens a causal? Why does it happen suddenly? Or
why does it happen at all, I guess?
Yeah. But I mean, this happens through the ether fluid. So basically, the idea is that when a black hole forms and there's ether fluid that has now higher pressure and that can propagate and change the space time metric. I'm not sure that's true, because I haven't solved the time dependent equations. I only solved the static equations, so I can't really tell you how fast this is going to happen. I imagine it would happen with the speed of light, but. Since I haven't solved the time-dependent equation, I'm not sure if I have it. I don't know how it
is. You also have spurt frames.
Sure. That's right.
So are you saying that the epoch of inflation occurs when it does because that's when the black hole density is at a maximum?
No, I'm just saying that when you form black holes, then there is this then there is this effect that causes acceleration. If you don't have the black holes, It's not that, that just when you start forming black, right when you form black holes, you have acceleration. It's just that there is this scale that can give you acceleration. It just happens to be the right scale for two acceleration that we observed today.
I'm still puzzled because, you know, for example, supermassive black holes probably form very quickly.
Yeah.
And so, why didn't acceleration happen?
Well, I mean, they did form probably, and they give you a value for P naught. But the thing is that if they form at early times, that's got to be much smaller than the mean density of the universe. So it doesn't really give you acceleration. So you should wait until the mean density of the universe falls below this until you see an effect.
Maybe
you
should.
Thank you.